morning. Today we're going to talk about something called the Higgs low energy theorem. And we're going to go back to this calculation of Higgs to glue glue, which we already computed. And there's actually, so it was a bit complicated to compute the amplitude. We had to compute these one loop diagrams, these vertex diagrams, do some integrals and compute them. But there's actually kind of a nice trick, which is a lot simpler to compute this amplitude. And so we're going to go through this. This goes under the name of the Higgs low energy theorem. What I want to say is that there's a trick to compute the Higgs to glue glue amplitude from the beta function for QCD. So the task of computing this amplitude is actually, ultimately, you can really just compute contributions to the beta function for the strong coupling and use what you compute and just plug that in, and that fixes the amplitude for this process here, this three-body process, this three-point coupling. So we're going to go through how this works. Let me make one caveat here, that this trick is really only valid in the limit that the Higgs is very light. It's not a terrible approximation. It's better than it seems. So let me put it that way. Now, what we need to do is, to start with, let's put the Higgs to glue glue aside. What we're going to do is compute the contribution to the QCD running from the top quark. So the only thing we need to evaluate is this vacuum polarization diagram. Oops. So we have a gluon here with color index A, Lorentz index mu. Gluon here, color index B, Lorentz index nu. Here we have a top quark. We have momentum Q and momentum Q. We're not computing the whole QCD beta function. We're only computing the contribution from the top quark. And you'll see why that'll be relevant. But the contribution to the running of alpha S from fermions works exactly the same way as in QED. So we're going to use what you learned in a tutorial yesterday to compute this, or rather just write down the answer. The complication with the QCD beta function just comes from the non-abelian part of the interaction, so the gluon couplings. And those are not going to be relevant for this discussion, so it's going to be just the same as QED. So this is the vacuum polarization. So we'll compute it. So I'll just write this down. We have to evaluate the following. This d-dimensional integral, there's a minus one for the closed fermion loop. We have to take a trace. Let me write down some momenta. Let's say this is momentum k, and this will be momentum k plus q. So we have I k slash plus q slash plus mt over k plus q squared minus mt squared. minus I GS gamma mu TA times mu to the epsilon. We have I K slash plus MT over K squared minus MT squared minus I GS gamma nu TB mu to the epsilon. Okay, so this is, he probably already computed this yesterday. Now, so what the one thing we're going to do is we're going to work in D is equal to 4 minus 2 times epsilon dimensions. Some people just write 4 minus epsilon, but I always like to write 4 minus 2 epsilon. So then, remember you have these factors of mu to the epsilon appearing. And you have to introduce those because in D dimensions, our dimensionless coupling is no longer dimensionless. So what we have to do is write down GS in 4 dimensions goes to GS mu to the epsilon in D dimensions. And so, because our coupling now has dimension, mass dimension epsilon. Okay.
There is a new thing or not on the right white most. And what is the epsilon? What are the epsilon?
Well, the so new mu and nu are just hanging off the ends of this diagram. Okay. So there's a free mu and a free nu. And then the epsilon is related to D, the number of dimensions. So we're, do, we're doing dim reg.
The Greek index. Over epsilon.
Okay. Let me try to be less confusing. This would be alpha, and this would be alpha. Okay? All right. Now, I apologize. Do you mind if I just switch back to new? Otherwise, I'll just get confused. Yeah. Okay. Now, you computed exactly this yesterday. So, I'll just write down the answer. Is that true? You guys computed it, right? Oh. I got too excited. Is that right? K slash new. Okay, I think this is okay. So the calculation is exactly the same except for the appearance of these generators. So, we have I alpha s over 4 pi, a trace over TA TB, and then we have Q mu Q nu minus Q squared eta mu nu, and then we're left with this Feynman parameter integral over dx of the following. There's an 8x, 1 minus x, and then we have an integral of 1 over epsilon minus this Euler-Mascheroni constant plus log of 4 pi plus the log of mu squared over mt squared minus q squared times x, 1 minus x. Okay. This is the same same as in QED. But we've replaced the electromagnetic fine structure constant by a strong fine structure constant times the trace of these generators.
What's gamma E?
This Euler-Mascheroni constant. It's like 0.577 something like that.
Matrix.
It's not a matrix. It always appears when you do these loop integrals. Now, okay. So, we're going to go through the same exercise of using this diagram to compute the beta function, or rather, just this particular contribution to the beta function. So, what we'll do is, first of all, as we set epsilon to zero, we have a divergence here. So we need to eliminate the divergence by introducing a counter term. So here will be my counter term. So it's exactly the same as you would do in QED. You have this factor of Z3 minus 1. But here I added a superscript T just to note that I'm only including the top contribution to this renormalization factor Z3. OK. And so I'll take this factor of Z3t minus 1 to be the following. 1/2 alpha s let's see, what did I want to do here? Yeah, 1/2 times alpha s over 4 pi times this integral times this factor of 1 over epsilon minus gamma e plus the log of 4 pi. So I'm choosing my counter term so that it will exactly cancel off the 1 minus epsilon minus gamma e plus log 4 pi. So this particular prescription is known as MS bar. Which I'm not sure if you've heard of it before. It's known as, the MS stands for minimal subtraction. Minimal subtraction, which just means that you're introducing the minimum counter term to cancel off the divergence, which is just to subtract off the 1 over epsilon part. But now it's a MS bar, it's a modification of minimal subtraction. So I don't know exactly what the bar stands for, maybe modified, something like this. That means you're introducing the minimal counter term you need to cancel off, for convenience, the 1 over epsilon minus gamma e plus log 4 pi. So at the end of the day, it's a very simple prescription for renormalization. You don't really need to worry about introducing counter terms. You just compute things at one loop and just cross off the factors of 1 over epsilon minus gamma e plus log 4 pi and say that you've renormalized the theory. So all of this stuff is a constant, so I could do this integral over x. You get the following. Minus alpha s over 6 pi times 1 over epsilon minus gamma e plus log 4 pi. So this is our counter term. So from this renormalization factor Z3, we can compute the beta function. And let me just write down the argument. You need to think about something, the bare coupling and the renormalized coupling. And they're related through the following expression. So here's the bare coupling. It's formally infinite, but it is independent of the renormalization group scale mu. And it's related to the renormalized coupling, which is the finite quantity you want to compute. I should say in d dimensions, this is the coupling, times these factors, z1 over z2 times the square root of z3. So these different factors are just the different renormalization constants. Now, this particular contribution we're interested in works exactly the same as in QED. In QED, any contribution to Z1 and Z2 will cancel. And we're only interested in the contribution from the top quark to Z3. So I can write this as 1 over the square root of Z3 times mu to the epsilon GS with a T here, since this is only the top contribution, plus dot, 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 which means that we're neglecting other contributions. OK. So I can rearrange this expression a bit. So let me write it in terms of alpha. So alpha s would be z3t times mu to the minus two epsilon times alpha s for the bare coupling. So I've just squared this equation, moved the z3 and the mu to the other side, and I get this expression. OK. Now this factor here I can expand out. So what I get is one minus alpha s over 6 pi times this factor, 1 minus epsilon gamma e plus the log of 4 pi times mu to the minus 2e times alpha s times the bare coupling. So let me just make one point that alpha s is equal to the bare coupling at lowest order in alpha. Alpha to the zero, okay, and it's only different at higher orders in alpha s. Okay, now what I want to do is compute the beta function from this, from what I've written down. So I'll write this as beta s with a superscript t. S stands for the strong interaction, and t is we're only considering the top contribution. So this is defined as d alpha s by d log mu. And so this is mu times the derivative of alpha d mu. And so what I need to do is plug this into here and take the limit that epsilon goes to 0. So I should write the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of d by d log mu acting on the coupling here, which is z3t mu to the minus 2 epsilon and then alpha s. The bare coupling, the bare alpha s. Now, the bare coupling is just independent of mu. This z3 is also independent of mu, so it only really acts on this part here. So I get minus 2 epsilon times z3t mu to the minus 2 epsilon alpha S B. So in the limit that epsilon goes to zero, the only part that survives, so Z3 has this factor of one minus something that's one over epsilon. In the limit that epsilon goes to zero, the one part will go to zero, but where epsilon multiplies one over epsilon, I'll get something finite. So that will give me this factor of alpha S over three pi. And so let me also just write in limit as epsilon goes to zero times mu to the two minus two epsilon alpha S B. So this whole expression for the beta function is linear already in alpha explicitly out front. So if I'm interested in the lowest order terms in the beta function, I should just keep the lowest order terms in the Baer coupling. The lowest order term in the Baer coupling is just this one times this stuff. And so I can replace this by alpha S plus order alpha S squared, which I'm throwing away. So then I have the beta function is alpha S squared over 3 pi. OK, now let me, so the whole thing is proportional to alpha S squared. And let me just write the proportionality factor as some constant, which I'll call B sub T. And this B sub T will just be 1 over 3 pi. This is just the top contribution to the beta function. Let me just, for completeness, note the full QCD beta function. So beta sub s is d alpha s d log mu. It's minus 11 minus 2/3 nf, and then alpha s squared over 2 pi. NF is the number of fermions that you have. The contribution from one fermion is plus 2/3 times alpha S squared over 2 pi. And this is exactly what we wrote here, BT times alpha S squared. So what we've computed is just the contribution to the beta function from one fermion case. Okay. So I think that was obvious. But it agrees with the standard formula. All right, so we've gone through this exercise. And you may be wondering, what does this have to do with Higgs to gamma gamma? So let's connect that. So let's first recall the Higgs to gamma gamma amplitude. It was minus I alpha S over 3 pi V times these polarization vectors. And they had P nu, P prime mu minus P dot P prime A to mu nu times delta AB. We evaluated this in the limit that MT was much larger than MH. Now, this is essentially an effective coupling between the Higgs bosons and the Higgs boson and gluons. So we can actually represent this matrix element directly in the Lagrangian by a non-renormalizable interaction. So we have an effective HGG vertex, or interaction. And it takes the following form. So the overall factor is alpha s over 6 pi v times the Higgs field times the trace of g mu nu. OK? How do I know it's this? Well, if you compute the matrix element due to this particular coupling, you'll get exactly this matrix element. That's how I know. Now, so this is what we're shooting for. But let's go back to the vacuum polarization amplitude and see how we can get this from that. Yes?
Just going back to the formula you have for the beta function. 11 minus 2 thirds nf, if nf is 1, is not 2 thirds, right?
That is correct. But that's not what I'm interested in. I'm only interested in the contribution, not from the gauge part of the beta function, but only from the fermion part of the beta function. So on the dot, dot, dot here, that's the minus 11 parts. But I'm only interested in purely the contribution from the quark itself. So we'll go back to this vacuum polarization. And let me write down the amplitude again. So we had I. Now the overall coefficient in front of this amplitude just ends up being the same coefficient that ends up in the beta function. So I had this factor of bt appearing in the beta function, and that came from the overall coefficient in front of this diagram. So I can write it in terms of bt. So I have bt times alpha s times q mu q nu minus q squared eta mu nu. I have the trace of TA, TB, and this factor of 1 minus epsilon minus gamma E plus the log of 4 pi plus the log of mu squared over MT squared. I'm writing this down in the limit that MT squared is large. So I'm going to take the limit that MT squared is much, much larger than Q squared. There was another term in the denominator here that depended on q squared. I'm throwing that term away. Okay. So, we still don't have any Higgs. We have to ask, how does the Higgs field couple to TT bar? So the interaction takes the following form. So there's a factor of mt, there's a t bar t, and then there's 1 plus h over v. So if I have mt appearing in my amplitude, I can generate the effect of the Higgs field coupling to those external states by a shift in the top quark mass. So we'll generate the Higgs glue-glue coupling vertex from the gluon-gluon amplitude by a shift of mt goes to mt times 1 plus h over v. So now I just take this shifted mass and plug it in here. So I have I times bt times alpha s q mu q nu minus q squared eta mu nu. I have this trace over color. I have this factor of 1 minus 1 over epsilon minus gamma e plus log of 4 pi. I have plus the log of mu squared over mt squared times 1 minus h over v squared. And so I can separate the logs. So I would have minus the log of 1 plus h over v squared. So I can bring that out and just multiply it by 2. So now, I'm only interested in terms that involve one Higgs. This is just Higgs to glue-glue, not multiple Higgs going to glue-glue. So let me Taylor expand my log in powers of h, since I only want the term that's linear in h. So there'll be terms zeroth order in h, which is what we already wrote down before. And then there'll be a term linear in h that's minus I2 bt alpha s q mu q nu minus q squared eta mu nu times the trace of ta tb. And then there's a power of h over v. And then there's higher order terms as well, h squared, h cubed, etc. So we've only kept the linear term. So this is what we were after, a coupling of the Higgs fields, the two gluons. And I can represent this matrix element as an effective interaction in the Lagrangian, in a non-renormalizable Lagrangian. And the interaction is this Higgs to glue-glue coupling, so it involves this coefficient bt times alpha s over 2 times the VeV, the Higgs field, and then the trace of g mu nu, g mu nu. And again, how do I know it's this? Well, if I compute the matrix element, I'll get this. And that's how I match them together. So this coefficient, if I just plug in for bt, is so bt was 1 over 3 pi, and so I get alpha s over 6 pi v. So it's exactly as we got before, the same coefficient as we did by the direct calculation. But you can kind of understand a deeper meaning now. It's exactly the same overall coefficient that ends up appearing in the contribution to the beta function from the top quark. So this gives us a nice trick. We're computing Higgs couplings to gauge bosons at loop order. We can use the beta function or different beta functions. To compute the Higgs to gauge bosons couplings at loop order. Now, it's only valid if the Higgs is very light. Compared to the particle in the loop. So this is why we don't use all of the beta function. The non-abelian part of the beta function doesn't matter. The contribution from other light quarks doesn't matter as well, because those are very light compared to the Higgs, and so don't satisfy this restriction. OK. So this is a simpler way. Instead of computing these vertex loop diagrams, you only compute the beta function, or just rather contributions to the beta function, which only involves computing the divergent parts of two-point functions. So at the end of the day, it's a lot simpler method for this computation. But it's only valid in this limit. So strictly speaking, you won't get the exact answer with the precise numerical coefficient. OK. So we did this argument for Higgs to glue. We did the computation both ways. It's also useful for another type of process, which is very interesting, which is Higgs decaying into photons. So we can use a similar argument. For Higgs decaying into two photons. And this is a very important channel. This is how the Higgs was discovered. So even though the branching ratio is very small, this process is very, very important. Now, if you want to compute this process, it's actually a lot more complicated than what we did already. So first of all, I would have diagrams like this, which would be very similar to the gluon-gluon calculation, just involving the top loop like this. And the calculation goes through exactly as what we did for gluons. But for the case of photons, there's another contribution which is very important, or I should say another class of contributions which is important, where we have gauge bosons appearing in the loop. So here I could have the W. So this part is similar to Higgs to glue. This part, it's not just this one diagram, but there's actually many, many diagrams, is very complicated. So just doing the loop calculation is quite non-trivial. So the argument that you'll have to go through in tutorial today is you will have to use the low energy theorem to compute Higgs to two photon decay amplitude. And so I'm just going to sketch how the calculation would work. And then you'll have to fill in the details during tutorial. And I'm going to write down what the answer should be. We're not 100% convinced that that's what it should be, but hopefully you will be able to reproduce these numbers. So we'll use the low energy theorem. So I need to compute the QED beta function contributions from the top and the W. Okay, the top is just a fermion. You already did this yesterday. But this part is a bit more non-trivial, but I think still feasible. So you'll have to see if you can do it. So here's sort of the types of things you'll have to compute. So for example, you have the vacuum. So all you need to do is compute vacuum polarizations. And only the divergent part. So for example, you'll have the top loop. OK, this part is straightforward. And then you'll have the W loop plus dot, 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 because there's it's a little bit more involved for the W, as you'll see. So these two contributions give rise to terms in the beta function. So I can write down the electromagnetic beta function, which is d alpha electromagnetic by d log mu. And I can write this as a term. So I'll have a bt times alpha electromagnetic squared plus a term that goes like bw, alpha electromagnetic squared, plus dot, dot, dot. Obviously, there's more contributions, like from the electron, et cetera, that I don't care about because they're light compared to the Higgs mass. But I only want these. Then, once I've computed these coefficients, I can essentially just write down the answer using the Higgs low energy theorem. So if I do a shift in the masses, mt goes to mt 1 plus h over v, and mw goes to mw times 1 plus h over v, then I generate an h gamma gamma coupling of the following form. So it would be bt plus bw times alpha over 4 times the VEV times h times f mu nu, f mu nu. So all I need to do is compute these coefficients, and then I can write down this vertex. And then you are essentially done. You've computed, you can compute the matrix element. So I only need to tell you what these coefficients are, and hopefully you'll get the same answer, although I'm not 100% sure that they're right. So this first one is pretty straightforward. You get this factor of 8 over 9 pi. And for the W one, it's maybe more non-trivial, but I claim that it should be given by 7 over 2 pi. OK, so this is what you should get. So hopefully, hopefully you will confirm this, or you'll figure out what the right answer is. Now, you might be a little bit worried because this is only really valid in the case of a very light Higgs. The Higgs is much lighter than the terms that I'm the masses that are relevant here, which is the top and the W. So, OK, obviously, this is not true because the W is, in fact, lighter than the Higgs. So what am I doing? But actually, it's better than that. So it works a little bit better. And you're helped out by one particular fact, which is the scale that I should be comparing to is not actually these two masses, but just twice their mass, since I have two of them appearing in the loop. So to make this a little more concrete, remember when we did the loop integral for Higgs to glu-glu, the relevant quantity appearing under the integral was the following ratio. So the relevant parameter was in fact mh squared, I can write it like this, mh over 2 mt quantity squared. So when we did our loop integral, this is what the parameter was appearing. So obviously, if this is true, this is obviously small, but this is really the parameter I should be checking. So for the top mass, this number is 0.1. And for the W, it's the same quantity, just with the W mass. And the number is around 0.6. So as long, it's less than one, so it's not terrible, right? But okay, it's not greater than one, otherwise we would be sunk. So at the end of the day, what we're doing is really only going to be valid at sort of this level, like within sort of a factor of two. This one will only give you a 10% correction, but this is sort of at the factor of two level. So so there you go. Okay. This is all I had to prepare on the standard model. So let's just pause here and see if there's any questions. Otherwise, we're going to go on. So if you have any questions on this beta function argument, then now is the time. Otherwise, yes.
Do you only apply this to QCD? Could you do a similar thing in QED?
So this is the argument. We're going to be doing this for QED, for the Higgs photon coupling. So the beta function that you have to compute would be the QED beta function. But it's strictly speaking not QED because we're not considering the electron. We consider the top and also a vector, the W, a charge vector. So it's QED, but with different fermions compared to QED, canonical QED. Yes?
So just to understand, we compute these beta functions to get these coefficients, BT and BW. And then we argue they also appear in our Lagrangian as a couplings.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I see the connection or how we know this is BT and BW, the one that I...
Yeah, so I, so we, sure. I think it may still be written up here.
Okay.
So this is what we computed from the vacuum polarization diagram.
Okay.
And it's obvious that this is the coefficient appearing in the beta function. Since it's the vacuum polarization coefficient that is what appears in the beta function, right? Okay. So now this vacuum polarization amplitude has two parts. One is this stuff here, which is what I absorbed into the counter term, but it always comes along with this term here, which involves this top mass. And so now if I do this shift to the top quark mass by shifting it by the Higgs field itself, it's the same coefficient appearing in both, so it's the beta function coefficient here, but it's the same beta function coefficient that is proportional to this shifted term. Okay, any other questions on this? So, okay, so we are done discussing the standard model. Of course, there's lots more to talk about with the standard model, but with 13 lectures, can't really do everything. But it's nice to talk a little bit about problems with the standard model and extensions of the standard model that try to deal with those problems. So we're going to talk for the next lecture plus 10 minutes about these issues. And so now, actually, let me just start by asking you all a question. It's always something I'm curious about. So now that you've learned about the standard model for the first time, and you've finally gotten some awareness about it, is the standard model a beautiful theory, or is it not a beautiful theory? So that's what I want to ask. So just please humor me and raise your hand. Do you think it is actually a beautiful theory? OK. And is it not a beautiful theory? So is it an ugly theory, would you say? You think it's ugly? OK, great. Interesting. So there's no right or wrong answer. It's just dependent on your taste. But definitely, there are unsolved problems with the standard model. And one of the biggest ones is really just an experimental fact that we know neutrinos must have mass. So, and the standard model, strictly speaking, has massless neutrinos. So this will be the first issue that we'll discuss, how to include neutrino masses in the standard model. Now, we know their masses exist, but they seem a little bit peculiar compared to all of the other fermions, just because the neutrino masses are all very, very small compared to everything else. So the masses are very small, which means that they're around below an electron volt. So you know, at least a million times smaller than the other lightest particle, the electron. So why are they so small but still non-zero? That is one question. Now, it is actually very straightforward to include neutrino masses in the standard model in the usual way that we've done for everything else. We can include these masses. By the usual Yukawa interaction. So first of all, the Yukawa interaction involves left-handed and right-handed fields coupled together. I need to introduce the right-handed neutrino fields. So the field would be nu r, and I is the generation label. I goes from 1, 2, and 3. Strictly speaking, I actually don't need all three of them. I could get away with two, but let's not worry about that. So I should write down a Yukawa interaction. For the neutrino fields, it looks like this. So I have some new Yukawa matrix, y nu ij, nu bar right I. I need to couple it to the left-handed lepton, doublet lj transpose epsilon h plus Hermitian conjugate. Remember, this epsilon is acting on the SU2 indices. So I have an SU2 doublet, an SU2 matrix, and then another SU2 doublet all contracted together. And if I expand this out in unitary gauge for the Higgs boson, for the Higgs doublet, I get minus nu right I y nu ij over v times the square root of 2. And then I have v left j times 1 plus h over v plus Hermitian conjugate. So now I want to go through exactly the same exercise as we did for all of the other fermions. We need to diagonalize this mass term by going from this this basis, this original basis, to the mass eigenstate basis. We need to do a biunitary transformation. So I would need to rotate the left and right-handed neutrino field separately by a different unitary transformation. And so this is U nu left right ij nu left right j prime. So we're rotating these fields. Let me just write down that the primed fields are the mass eigenstates. And the unprimed fields are the original gauge eigenstates. So now that, in general, the mass and gauge eigenstates are no longer the same, we run into the same issue that we had for quarks in the charge-current interaction, namely that it's no longer diagonal. Before, the charge-current interaction was diagonal, just because we defined the gauge eigenstate for the neutrino fields to be the same as for the charged leptons. Now we can't do that anymore, because the mass term picks out a particular basis of eigenstates. Charge current is no longer diagonal. So I'll write down the charge current interaction. We have minus g over 2, square root 2. We have a matrix, u, which I'll write as uji star, nu bar prime I left, gamma mu E I prime left, plus Hermitian conjugate. Oh, this should be a J. This matrix U, forgot one thing, times a W. Should be a W minus. Then the Hermitian conjugate would be g over square root 2 u j I, and I should have e bar prime j left gamma mu nu left I prime, and then w minus, like this. Okay, so this matrix U is the product of these two unitary transformations acting on the left-handed charged lepton and the left-handed neutrino. So when I try to diagonalize both of these two fields, they don't exactly cancel off, and I'm left with this matrix left over, the same way you get the CKM matrix. And this particular matrix U is known as the PMNS matrix, which stands for Pontecorvo, Maki, Nakagawa, and Sakata. Since they were the first to write down this particular diagonalization. Okay. So you might say, OK, we've written down a mass term, we've diagonalized everything, and we're done. We're not done. And we'll talk about this tomorrow. But the reason is that there still are more mass terms we can write down. And the reason is that the new field that we introduced was actually a singlet under all of the standard model quantum numbers. So the same argument that we used before is that because the standard model gauge interactions were chiral, we couldn't write down any mass terms for any of the fermions in the standard model. This right-handed neutrino field is a singlet. It's not have the mass terms are not protected in any way by any of the symmetries. And so we will be able to write down additional mass terms, and we'll see what the implication of those mass terms are tomorrow.